Call me old man Waves.
Damn you, old man!
Wait.
Old ass man.
Shut up, old man. You smell like fart.
No. Man.
Old man.
Wait. He's so old, he got a podcast on cassette.
Fuck, you're old.
Damn it, Wade.
And welcome to the Old Man Wade Show. I am your host, the God of Stubborn, the Lord of Laughter, the apparent petty Old Man Wade. And I have some special guests here, something I've actually been waiting for the last couple of weeks. I love having creatives come on the show and talk about their projects and talk about their work. And this will be probably the first time I've hosted more than four people at a time. So this is new for me. So all the listeners, I apologize if I collapse and stutter along the way, but thankfully I have an amazing group of people. And even though she said she didn't want to go first, I'm putting her on the spot, and she is going to go first. Nicole, tell everybody who you are.
My name is Nicole Gibbons-Kurtz, and I am the publisher of Mocha Memoirs Press. I'm also a science fiction and fantasy author. I write cyberpunk mysteries, fantasy mysteries, and weird westerns.
What's a weird western?
It's a western that takes place, it can either take place in an unknown frontier, or it can take place in the American West, and things that are supernatural, things that are supernatural, spectral, or strange. Think like Jonah Hex, or the Wild Wild West, or even Cowboy Bebop, Firefly. These are things that are considered westerns, but they're very strange because they have things that are aberrant about them that didn't actually exist in the West.
Gotcha. And next up we have Cherie.
Hi, I'm Cherie Renee Thomas, greeting you from Memphis, Tennessee. And I write mostly fiction and poetry, occasionally an essay. Have a debut collection called Nine Bar Blues, Stories from an Ancient Future, out from Third Man Books. And I am excited to be in Slay with the first vampire story I've written in 100 years, it seems like.
Okay,
and
well,
called Love Hangover, yeah.
So with that being said, you said it's been 100 years. Are you, in fact, a vampire?
I am not a vampire, thank goodness. But I am something else. We call it old souls where I'm from.
And Steve tells you you have a podcast.
No, I do not have a podcast.
Who had the podcast?
Aledria
has a podcast.
Aledria has a podcast. Okay, so I completely jumped the gun. So, okay, since we're there, Aledria, tell us about yourself.
Hi, I'm Aledria Hurt, and I am the author of fantasy, sci-fi, and horror. I have a podcast called There's Stories Everywhere, in which I discuss not only the story, but also the genesis of the story. I'm also a Twitch streamer and a YouTuber.
What do you do on Twitch and YouTube? Is it the same thing like the podcast, or are you like gaming and stuff like that?
I actually write on Twitch.
Really?
How's that work? I write. I straight up share my screen and I type. Like, my hands are on fire.
I never thought that Twitch could be a platform like that. I'm 1,000 years old, so like I don't know how technology works. And I keep calling it a Switch, even though that's a Nintendo thing. I didn't know you could actually literally just share the screen and, like, as you type. How does it flow? Like, how do people, like, interact with you while you're doing this?
Well, one of the things that we do is we run what are called sprints, which means that for about 10 to 15 minutes, we are busy. Everybody's working on their own project. We're all kind of quiet. And then we spend 5 to 10 minutes chatting in between sprints. So for like 15 minutes, I am working. And then after that, I'm talking to the people who show up in my chat. I'm sharing stuff with them that I've done for my research. I'm doing things that allow them to interact with my project. And occasionally, because we have the Twitch Writers Network, we raid each other. So we will take the group that is at our Twitch stream and take them over to somebody else's Twitch stream and be like, hey, there's this other person, you should follow them too.
That's a dope idea, especially for people. And because everyone here is a writer, I think that's actually a cool idea, because like sometimes it's it's great when you can see someone else doing the same thing you're doing, and it kind of inspires you to want to do more and be more when you see that other people are in the same boat you are, especially when it's in a positive place.
Yeah, we do a lot of sharing amongst ourselves. We're very supportive of one another. We try to make sure that everybody, you know, gets some love on their project, and, you know, we work through plot holes together. We work through anything and everything. We help each other do research. We're just basically a network of people who all have the same kind of idea of what should be done. So we're all just really cool with each other.
That's dope. I love that. Steve, you've been on the show a million and one times. The fans love you, but introduce yourself yet again.
Sure. So I'm Steve Ann Sampson. I am a horror author primarily, but what I like to say is my stuff tends to be on the pulpy side. I'm a real big fan of, you know, the pulps of the 30s and 40s and even earlier as well. Basically, anything that is tinged with adventure is kind of my bag, so I'm happy to write, you know, straight up horror, sci-fi, fantasy. I just actually, my next thing is actually a dark fantasy book that's going to be released from Rough House Publishing. I'm really excited about that. That should be out soon. But like, also weird westerns. You guys were mentioning weird westerns. So Nicole, I didn't realize that you dabbled in that. And that is something that I dabble in. I don't know. Maybe you don't dabble. Maybe you're a master. I'm not sure. But I love weird westerns a lot. And I love mixing genres. And just sort of, you know, to me, adventure means you're adding excitement, and it becomes more of a like second to second tense experience that you're trying to get through something. That tends to be kind of my stories, I guess. But yeah, I also am a co-host of the Retro Reductibus Cephala podcast, and a lot of these ladies tonight actually were on an episode that's going to be airing pretty soon, and that was really fun. So yeah, I think that's it. My books are, my first two books are actually vampire related, and they also take place in Africa. So when I found out about this amazing collection Slay, that this was going to be a thing, I jumped at it, and I was like, oh my gosh, if there's any way I can be in this, like I gotta at least try. So I actually wrote a story for Slay that ties into my main book. So actually, if you read the story in Slay, No God But Hunger, it takes place directly before the events of my first book, The Bone Eater King.
Oh, nice. So,
yeah.
So, just to have a little fun, a little goofiness in this, I play this game called This or That. This or That. This
or That. This or That. This or That. Well, there's all. Well, Penelope didn't say hi yet.
Oh, wow. I am a terrible host, and I apologize for that. Penelope.
I got you back.
Thank you. Penelope, feel free to virtually flog me for forgetting about you. I apologize for that. Penelope, tell everyone about yourself and everything.
I'm Penelope Flynn. I am a storyteller of science fiction, fantasy, horror, you know, speculative fiction. I do also write erotica, and kind of everything that I do is kind of like a mixture of all those things, you know, all together, kind of cross-genre kind of stuff. I do a lot of short stories and a lot of anthologies. My first actual novel, it's been in my head for a long time, was published last year, and that is regarding Koyescu, which is part of the Chronicles of Renfields. And the story that I have in the Slay anthology is a short story from the Chronicles of Renfields. And I mean, I have part of a podcast, a group does a podcast where I'm the host, but we're all just kind of all in there together, called Discussions from the Otherhood, which is a podcast for other sci-fi on TalkShoe, and it's Saturday nights, 9 o'clock Eastern. And in addition, every day, every weekday, Monday through Friday, I am on Twitch with Twitch TV, Amazing Experience, EMAZINGXP, Amazing Experience, where I take about an hour in the morning and basically create three-dimensional landscapes with Flowscape, and just sit there and talk for about an hour about whatever I just happen to be talking about. and just creating three-dimensional landscapes, and we post them at the end. And it's good, it's kind of good meditation to go through every morning, you know.
So, oh no, I was just gonna say, for the uninformed me, only thing I know about Renfield, sadly, is from Dracula Dead and Loving It.
Exactly. And Renfield is a character from Dracula. And what I did is, I'm a real big horror fan. Bram Stoker's Dracula, of course, figures high, you know, in that list of classic horror. But I had determined a long time ago, Renfield is like this lunatic, is an acolyte of the Count Dracula. But what if he was just an outlier? What if he wasn't the only one? What if there are these families of vampires all around us, and that their families of Renfields, whose jobs it is to maintain their households, get them their prey, or whatever you want to call them. They're called cattle in my parlance. So there's, you know, this whole society and system that exists, these Renfields, and they're all over the world, everywhere, been here for millennia doing this job. So this story that we have in Unfleamed is about how my characters, this world of this Renfield, this family, dovetails with the story of Bram Stoker's Dracula, and how it is like the basis of Dracula actually coming to England.
So what drew you to Renfield? Because it's not necessarily, he's not something that like the general public may know, or maybe they do, and I just, like I said, maybe I'm just uninformed. So what drew you to make a chronicle about like Renfield?
Well, to me, Renfield is an interesting character because he is an acolyte of Dracula. He is kind of like this wannabe, you know, he is kind of an outsider. And a lot of this, like, selected the Renfield characters, I always had an interest in it, but Renfields in my mythology are hybrids. They are vampire and human hybrids created for the purpose of serving them, because regular human beings would never live long enough. So they start out with these hybrids and then realize, you know, a vampire or revenant paradoxon human hybrid definitely lives a little longer. But then when you have these hybrids who are breeding together, then they have all the benefits of being the vampire, long life and vulnerabilities, but also they don't have the vulnerabilities of the revenants. But of course, the situation is that since they are built, born, bred to serve, regardless of how wealthy they are or, you know, how educated they are, they remain in that position. So it is kind of allegorical, you know, regarding the hybridized nature of African Americans, of being Western European culture and African by descent. So it is like my allegory of how I deal with our relationship to this place where we are. We have revenants who are one side of our lineage, and the paradoxons who are the other side of our lineage, and how you have to walk that line dealing with both of them, and that is the conundrum of being a Renfield.
Okay, that's actually dope. I never would have even thought about like him being someone that could be interesting, and that's amazing. And I've seen.
Can I just interject?
Go ahead, quick. Absolutely.
So. First of all, I just want you to, Penelope, please do me the favor of recording your own audiobooks, because literally I can listen to you read a phone book front to back, and I would be happy.
Thank you.
Your voice is so good and so soothing. I just want this entire thing to be just Penelope. I just want to listen to more Penelope. Like, please record your own audiobooks. I'm dead serious.
Thank you.
And just saying for Wade, it just so happens that I have also always been fascinated with the character of Renfield. For some reason, there's something about him. He's very mysterious in the book, especially. You never really learn how him and Dracula even met. In the Bela Lugosi movie from the 30s, they merged the character of Renfield with Jonathan Harker. So it sort of made sense. So, you know, there was no Jonathan Harker, or maybe there was, but he was just back in England and he was like a relegated to be one of the background characters. But Renfield is the one who goes to England to broker the deal and for the house back in England. And Dracula has to sign the papers, and then he kind of keeps him prisoner. But yes. In the book, that's Jonathan Harker. So when he gets to England in the movie, you feel like, okay, well, he's brought Renfield with him to keep him safe on the ship, and now he's crazy. So it sort of makes sense, and he's played by Dwight Frye in the movie. And to me, Dwight Frye's performance is one of my favorites in that movie. But in the book, it's sort of like, you know, and it's the same way in the Bram Stoker's Dracula movie, the Coppola film. When we get back to England, he leaves Harker back in Transylvania. Yes. And when he gets to England, he just knows somehow something has happened that we never got to see. He somehow met Renfield, and Renfield is already in prison and crazy. It's like we never even see what happened to get him to that point. And he's not really that big of a character. He has a pivotal moment in the book, where he does turn on Dracula, yeah, and sort of redeem himself. But in the films, he's often just sort of forgotten. Like in Dead and Loving It, the Mel Brooks film that you mentioned, he's in it more, and obviously he's very different. But in other versions, a lot of times, including the Coppola film, I feel like he's sort of just abandoned. I don't think he has I could be wrong. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I don't really think he has a final point in that movie.
But I think the problem is that most of the time when people are doing Dracula movies, they basically are very stingy with Dr. Seward's role.
Yes.
And when you're stingy with Dr. Seward, you really are not going to get that much of a reveal. Because this is, you know, this is Dr. Seward's portion of the book.
Yes.
And he discusses this relationship that he has with Renfield, how he's trying to feel him out and figure out what is going on with this individual. So I think it comes from that if they played up Dr. Seward's role more, you would have more of Renfield. But they a lot of times just gloss over Dr. Seward.
Yeah. I think we need to come back and have a discussion with just us and anybody who else wants to just talk about Dracula.
Yeah,
I could do that for 2 hours, but
I could
probably shouldn't keep going.
I could too.
I'm in. I'm totally in.
Yes.
I know Sheree is on a schedule for today, so maybe we should.
Yeah, okay. All
right, so how about we do this? Sheree, how about we get, because like I said, you do got to go, and I know that like it's time restricted. So how about you tell us about your story, and if you do have time, give us a reading.
Okay, I would love to, absolutely. Just say this has absolutely nothing to do with Dracula or Renfield. So tap out of that conversation. My story is called Love Hangover, and it's actually set in the 1970s, exciting nightclub scene with discos. So this is a different kind of creature that lives off life forces, nearly immortal, but certainly not completely unable to be killed, let's put it like that. So when Nicole put out the wonderful call for Slay, the collection of stories, the first thing I was thinking about is, you know, how many times have I seen black vampires or black vampire-like creatures in, you know, in the media, in movies. And of course you think of the brother with the dreads in the Twilight movie who didn't last very long, didn't have many lines, or you think of Midnight Texas, which was an interesting show. Or you think of the wonderful, wonderful character, Tara, on True Blood, you know? And I guess one of my favorite all-time vampires is of course, Ganja from Ganja and Hess, right? Which is Bill Gunn's wonderful movie that he did. And of course, Spike Lee did his version of it later with the sweet blood of Jesus. But I wanted to take it in a different direction. So that's what happens with Love Hangover. And it gave me a good opportunity to listen to some great music from the time period that I was born too late to party in. But yeah, so that's Love Hangover. Over. Yeah.
Would you like to give a reading, or do you want to? Because okay, first of all, let me get this. The name alone drags me in. Like the idea of a love hangover, like something that could be so strong that like, but it's like when you drink out, when you're drinking and you're having a good time, like you know, you feel the pain of like you know of that good time. So attributing that to love sounds like a really deep story.
Yeah, I wanted to play with the idea of, you know, how people don't necessarily come to each other as whole personalities, you know, and if you have something that's a bit of a predator, they can take advantage of that, you know, and they actually seek people who aren't necessarily whole beings, so they can be their Renfields, I guess, in that way. Yes, to play with the, you know, the red lights that you, red flags you should pay attention to, but you don't, because you're on your own mission. You have your own fantasy of what a relationship is and what a person is. And also the idea of celebrity culture, because the thing that I think is so interesting about that era of music, of the disco era, is that that was an opportunity for the people who were in the audience, or as they say, the consumers, to be like stars themselves. So you can go into a club and you couldn't tell who was the celebrity and who was, you know, who was the audience, because they were all dressed in these like amazing fashions and they all had a particular air. It's all performance, you know? And it was a time where people, you know, there was more equality, I guess you could say, between those who were on the mic and those who were, you know, out around them dancing. Regular people got a chance to become well known. And I believe Grace Jones got her start in one of the clubs, actually. She went from modeling to performing, just being a, you know, the wow, amazing personality that she is on the dance floor. So she created a following that way.
Yeah. What gave you the idea to the story? Like, why, one of the things I love is the creative process of stories like this. So what was your process? What gave you the idea for this?
Well, the way I usually approach stories is that the characters come to me first, and I'm not quite sure what their story is or who they are or where they are. And I just, you know, pay attention until, you know, I'm starting getting the threads on them. And the first thing that came to me was Delilah, who she was, where she was. It was kind of surprising when I realized, oh, this is this is during the disco era. And I kind of connected her to another character I have in my Nine Bar Blues collection, a story called Head Static, which deals with immortal DJs who travel through the world collecting music and sounds for their own purposes. And so she's related to one of the characters in that. So I kind of went from there. And zeroing in on a specific club too, yeah.
Okay. So, before you go, would you like to do a reading of Love Hangover?
That would be awesome. That'd be great.
Go right on.
All right. Love Hangover. That night, disco records were the only things that burned. I lost someone irreplaceable, a creature that lived off blood and music, the life force of a people, but a creature that was also my friend. Delilah brings it, I mean, she brings it 100%. Delilah Divine sang, girl, sang. Delilah teased death the way she teased her fans, her voice an odd constellation of sound. She tasted death and knew she would always live in one form or the next, like a singer resurrected in the record's groove. Every night was a different club, one after the other. 16 on a hi-hat, 4 on the floor, 2 and 4 on the backbeat. That was a sound that announced her arrival in all of disco. Like Delilah Divine's voice, the music was sweet water finding its own way home. It was going to get through, just a matter of time. The challenge was finding a way to listen and not get drenched. With Delilah, you drowned. The first night I met Delilah, she danced on a speaker box. Bianca Jagger rode by on a white horse, her black locks shining ebony waves, but all eyes returned to Delilah. To say she was a vision is to insult the very nature of sight. Beauty is internal and eternal, and Lila's beauty came through in her songs. Motown funk, soft Philly soul, and salsa. It wasn't what she said, not the lyrics nor the music with its lush orchestral arrangements. Her soaring vocals with reverb. It was the story that was beneath her words and music, the message she carried within. And the message, it was about freedom. That's what the sound was and the movement. We danced to be free. Candy Staten sang from her heart, and that's why we loved her songs too. I had no idea how true her lyrics would be. Self-preservation is what's going on today. Delilah started off singing jazz, top 40 hits. When DJs arrived in clubs carrying crates between sets, she and the other vocalists sang for their own survival, and sing she did. I loved the way I moved when her music was on, the way we dove and split from our old selves into something sensual and new, the way the dance floor took us in, wet and holy in its mouth. We were all glitter and steam, blurred blazing bodies spinning in the music's light. If I turned away from the hypnotic rhythm and the beats, from Delilah's seductive song and dance, I could have saved myself and a whole lot of dead people a lot of trouble. Heartache was Delilah's last name. Nothing else was fitting. Young hearts just run free. Delilah only had time for the young, and none of us, not a single soul, could run away or leave her embrace. She was like Diana's song. If there's a cure for this, I don't want it. I don't want it. I thought about Delilah all the time, and she gave me and all her fans the sweetest hangover. When Delilah got into your bloodstream, she controlled lives, heartbeats. I practically lived in the clubs just to catch a glimpse of her. Now, the club's appeal was that the ultimate rocker lifestyle was available to anyone who could manage to get in. When I first met Delilah, it seemed like she was always in the club, as if she emerged from beneath the parquet floors fully formed. Dressed in slinky silk dresses that wrapped her curves in silver-tinged moonlight, Delilah was a vision. You couldn't turn away from her, and believe me, many tried, only to find themselves in her thrall. But music was her spell. DJs played with minds, stories told with songs seeped into your soul. Walk through a door in the forest, no confidence at all. But in music, spirits take shape. I became who I wanted to be, what I needed. Dancing with Delilah Devine was like that. 5 a.m. when the club was closed, most others would stumble their way home or fall into the faded booths of a diner. Delilah wouldn't want rest or breakfast. She wanted to be near water. So strange. Delilah would sit next to the ferns and bulrushes. She said, unlike the clubs, the green life formed a wall of kindness. She would bend her ear to the waves that lapped up against the shore, whispering to voices I couldn't hear. I tried to reach her with a joke, some laughter, or a bit of gossip, anything that might hold her attention, pull her from the faces, the arms I couldn't see. But she was lost in the waters, in search of depths where she could drown her weight of years. What she sought to drown was not a name, but her history. Sometimes she spoke as if she lived beyond her 20-odd years. Lila lived for the rust of songs, for the scars and cutting parts of choruses, the hooks that dug in your soul and made you cry from recognition of depths. She wanted to laugh with the joy of it and dance until you couldn't reach the gray vaults of sea. She said her sisters waited for her on the other side, but she couldn't swim her way back to them, said she was already drowned. Each night at the club, I watched her struggle to breathe. They played her songs before I knew they were her songs. String sections and synthesizers, syncopated bass lines and horns, and that voice, that incredible voice. She danced as if the music was a stranger, as if the songs were notes that came out of another's throat. Where did you learn to sing like that, I asked. She looked at me with dead fish eyes that should have run me away, but I was already hers before the first time we even touched or danced. From the throats of 1,000,000 men and women. But the children, she said, closing her eyes as if the memory pained her. Their voices, too sweet. I can't bear the taste of their songs. I thought she was high. I'd seen her with her blow and biscuits, poppers and whippets, whatever made the music and lights, the dance and the tempo last a little bit longer. What do songs taste like, Lila? Like ambergris and champagne. She spun around, eyes staring straight up. They come back, she pointed. The disco ball was the largest in the studio. It reflected the jewel-toned beams of the strobe lights. We used to party with these in the 20s back in Berlin. Berlin! Lila, you're only 20, if that. How would you know how flappers party then? She stopped spinning with a shrug. Saw it in a movie? She asked. Mirror balls. Die Symphonie der Großstadt. Die Symphonie der Großstadt, she shouted, then repeating her spinning top dance. Her nipples brushed the sheer fabric of her teal jewel-tone dress. I forced my eyes from staring. Instead, I watched her sleeves flutter and float, gossamer moth wings. Lila favored dresses that made her look as if at any moment she could fly away. She was always so restless, like a hummingbird, a kind of lightning flow through her, even without the drugs.
She was never fully present. Her eyes, her mind, the random stories, her memories, she claimed, will burst from her at any moment. And the voices no one heard but her. I thought she was a little schizophrenic and mentioned it to a doctor friend, a shrink who frequented the clubs with us. No, he said, after chatting with her, drink in hand. Frankie, that one's very clear. Lila was like standing on a hill with the weeds and the wildflowers, the wind blowing through me. If I wasn't so determined to pretend that I didn't imagine her breast in my mouth, the soft curve of her belly beneath the silk skin, I would have seen the telltale signs of the monster she really was, the creature she hid. The garage on 84 King Street became our paradise. The club was like church. More than gospel piano riffs threaded through 22-minute extended versions of songs, there we had chosen family. Delilah was mine. I didn't know who I was until I came there. Then I found out I was everybody, and everybody was me. No judgments, everyone enjoying themselves, love, peace, unity, unforgettable happiness. And then there was blood. Though I wanted her more than my own disappointing life at the time, Delilah never wanted me. She said there wasn't enough music in my blood to sustain her, not enough firelight and smoke. You've made up your mind to die young, Frankie, she said one night after we left the dance floor, having spent hours studying the power of sweat. She would dance with other bodies, take one or two back into the VIP rooms, but she always found her way back to me. When she returned, she was uncomfortably clear, her edges more precise. Before she disappeared with her various lovers, she was like a channel on the television or radio dial that you can sort of see and hear, but doesn't quite come through. You would try to turn it left or right, experiment with various degrees of movement, but there was always a kind of distortion, a slow rupturing of meaning, of sound, and feeling. Lila was mercilessly blunt. It's your choice, of course, Frankie, Delilah said. No judgment or pity, just straight no chaser with Delilah the divine. But if you do, you'll never find your song then. They've run out of music on the other side, she said, and I ought to know. The sadness that shadowed her eyes deepened as she spoke. Sorry, Frankie, but you gotta live a little while longer, she said, throwing her head back. Until then, there's not much to take from you. She didn't want my heart, so I offered my body instead. She laughed. No, love, I told you I like you fine, Frankie. There's just not enough song in that stream of yours to make it worth the while. She said it slowly, as if explaining to a very small child. As they say, you couldn't carry a tune. She stroked my collarbone. Her touch felt like red streaks of fire. I wanted to kiss her and never ever stop, but her eyes were a warning. I thought her obsession with musicians was weird, but nothing my musical inability couldn't overcome. Ironically, she told me later, it's your lack of talent, my friend, that saved your life that night and every night since. So don't feel so bad about rejection. It's a blessing in disguise. Mother said I looked sad in childhood pictures because I was an old soul. I looked sad because I knew what lay ahead. The first time I saw Delilah's true form was an accident. It was the only time I was grateful I'd stayed conscious during those dry bone English lectures in college. It was Ovid and Hyginus who said the original sirens were friends of Persephone, the poor soul snatched up by Hades, forced to spend a season in the underworld. Ovid assumed they were good friends, loyal women turned into halflings. Transformed, they were the head of a woman and the body of birds. The wings were gifts to help set their abducted friend free. But Hyginus had a darker vision. He said the transformation was a punishment. The grieving mother Demeter cursed the jealous girls for not protecting their friend, her daughter, during the abduction. She blamed them for the rupturing of her family and cursed the young women to spend their lives as half human, half serpent or fish. From some craggy island in the middle of the Mediterranean, halfway between Africa and Europe, the legend of the sirens was born. But I was following the wrong legend. Delilah was something else. Something more ancient. Delilah wanted a drink. When I returned to our spot under the balcony, she was gone. I went searching. I know it's not attractive to be possessive of what was never yours and never would be, but that night, I didn't feel like being evolved. I wanted to find her so she could drink the bourbon before the ice melted, the drink I stood in line to get. I wanted to find her so she could bless me with a smile, approval, any kind of sign that I would be in her company again. When I stumbled into the storage room, a wet, panting sound drifted above the music's dull thud. Delilah? I walked in and a sharp iron scent assaulted me. I strained to see. The walls bled red. Claw marks covered everything. His or hers, I couldn't tell. The strange metallic scent I'd smell was that of someone dying. There's honesty in murder. It doesn't have to hurt, she said. The bearded man was slumped beneath her. His eyelashes twitched until they stopped. Lila's lips were stained as if she'd been eating strawberries. Doesn't even need to be blood. She stared at me. I just like the taste. Horror must have flickered in my eyes. She offered a wry smile, a lifeless explanation. My sisters would not approve. Fear gripped me. I concentrated to slow my breathing, to make my vocal cords work. Is that why you don't see them anymore? Why they went away? I managed, backing away. Creative differences, she said, her voice steely. You could say we broke up, like the Supremes. I'm the star now. I had the feeling she always was. Even as she drained whatever melodies and harmonies she could from the man's throat, the DJ played her song. She finished wiping her mouth and joined the chorus, adding impossible runs that no record label had ever recorded. You can't give them everything, Frankie, she said, smiling. Got to save some for you. A berry-sized crimson stain rested above the mole on her chest. She sniffed. As far as anyone knew, she could have been a nosebleed. She rose and adjusted the glimmering halter top. Her golden hair and pants shimmered around her hips. Don't look so mournful, Frankie, Delilah said. Yeah, Simeon was talented, but he was on his way out. She held up his limp arm, track marks and cuts like jagged railroads all along the stiffening flesh. She reached for me and I recoiled. I couldn't forget the young man's face. She took the drink instead. Blood and lipstick stained the highball glass. I watched her, frozen, unsure if I should run or stay. It wasn't the blood that killed them. It was the heartbeat, the life force in it. Delilah took their first music, the heart drum, the unique rhythm we are all born with. And then she took the last, all of it. She told me later that she'd stopped stalking churches and choirs. Too much practice, she said. Never-ending rehearsals, hollow hallelujahs. She stopped amateur nights, but they brought too much attention. So she settled on nightclubs instead. Satiated, Delilah's face switches textures and tone. First she is a diamond, now her face is the shape of the moon. I need water. She doesn't wait to see if I will follow her. Looking at the budding singer's lifeless body, I knew then why nightclubs were her favorite haunting grounds. Anonymous hookups and no real world connections. She could feed and still have time to dance until her feet went numb. And of course, vanity. The DJs played her record on constant rotation with the most popular beats, Donna and Diana. They called her the never can say goodbye girl because Delilah could dance all night. She shut the club down with her rhythm and song, killed it every time. Hers was a visceral music, the kind of hard-won grace that came from speaking across elements, living across time. She opened the door. When a cone of light revealed a second body slumped in the corner, I knew I needed to get away. After spending most of the night with her, I was running out of time, but she leapt on me. The glass crashed to the floor. My arm felt as if she wrenched it off. Her breath was overly sweet, the opposite of rot. Just because I can't feed from you doesn't mean I won't kill you, she said. I could feel her hunger across the still cigarette air. Her angled bones pierced the darkness, paralyzed me where I stood. She was on my throat before I could cry out. Her hands burned me. She released her palm, leaving me rubbing the slightly blistered flesh. We'll get along fine, Frankie, as long as you do what I say. I don't want to hurt you. Let's keep this cool. She nodded her head toward the door. What about them? I stammered. A bad trip. Won't be the first. It wasn't the last. Thank you.
Well, shit.
Wow.
Yeah.
Isn't it stunning? It's so, it's brilliant. Yeah. And okay, I'm going to start gushing, so I'm going to go back on mute.
Wow. Yeah, pretty much what Wade's saying.
It's poetry.
It's wow. That was amazing, Sheree. Thank you.
I know you gotta go, but I'm sitting here taking notes, and like there's certain parts on here that really just that hit at like someone who's aspiring to be a writer. Certain parts that, like you said, there was a with Delilah, you drown. When Delilah got into your bloodstream, I wanted her more than my disappointing life. It was your lack of talent that saved your life. thank you, Cherie.
I like the song references. That's a period. I'm like you. You know, I grew up during that period, but of course, was not old enough to party. So yeah. All things are like, wow, yeah.
I had the best fun researching this story, and I thank Nicole for the opportunity to work on it, because it would never have occurred to me to write a vampire story or an attempt at a vampire story. And just listening to the music was the best research ever. I mean, it's Diana and Donna Summers and the whole history of how her music came to be and Sylvester and just all the good stuff. Yeah. Yeah, but Delilah is not the one you want to meet at the club.
I mean, I don't know.
Well,
for real, it's like the
I mean, it kind of seems like it's worth it. I don't know.
It's like the Neo song "Beautiful Monster." It's like, you know what I mean, but I don't mind. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I think we have a story called "Beautiful Monsters." Valjean's story.
Yes, yes.
Valjean's
right.
Story is Beautiful, yeah. Monsters, yes. And amazingly, we did not have any. We have another story called The Last Dance that takes place in a reggae club.
Woo!
It's still a very different type of vibe than Cherie's, but it's still a gut punch. Like, at the ending is a gut punch. You're like, holy crap, I did not see that coming. but yeah, I'm telling you, and I've said this repeatedly, if you buy this, I would challenge anyone to find a single story. They can't find a single story that they like in this volume of stories. Like, there are so many different brilliant pieces. I think everyone, whether you're a vampire lover or not, would be able to find a story that you absolutely love. They are really that good.
Well, I think, shit, I'm sorry, I'm still taken aback by what I just heard.
Right?
All right, I'm gonna play the game.
You don't know how it's gonna hit, and you're like, well, this one is weird to me, and she's scary to me. Let's see what happens.
Do you do spoken word? Like, because that was, it was very, like, I really felt like I was sitting in the club listening
exactly.
to you.
Exactly, yeah.
You know what? By the time I got to spoken word, Saul Williams and all the, Jessica and all them had gone to Hollywood. I was at the Brooklyn Moon by my damn self. But no, I'm more of a poet on the page, and I just admire the spoken word poets who can, you know, perform live, completely memorize everything, like, you know, absolute amazing actors and performers, and it's beautiful on the page as well. But yeah, spoken word is not exactly my lane. But I can read.
Look, whatever you're doing, keep doing it.
Thank you.
yeah. okay, so... Cherie, you have to go, right?
Yeah, this is the part where you play Love to Love You. Love this mess with you. I have to go and work, unfortunately.
Before you go, are there any social media places where you can be followed?
Oh, yes. So I have a website. It's www.CherieReneeThomas.com. CherieReneeThomas Thomas, THOMAS.com. My dad liked E's and French names. And I'm also on social media, on IG and Facebook under Cherie Renee Thomas. And on Twitter, I'm under Blackpot Mojo. So,
all right. So thank you for doing that. Make sure you, this goes for everybody. Make sure you tag me in your social media so I can follow you, so I can have the people who listen follow you, because I want to promote you guys as much as all of you as much as possible.
Thank you, and I cannot wait to get this book in my hands so I can read all these great stories. Yeah, thank you so much.
Alrighty, thank you. Bye, Cherie. Thanks for coming
out.
Bye,
Cherie. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So we have a couple.
Now that the bar is set in the stratosphere.
So we have a couple of options. We can go right to a reading. We can play a quick game just to kind of like level it down a little bit.
Oh, I want to play a game. I don't want to follow that. I don't know if anybody else is up to it.
I'd do it.
You do it?
I'd do it.
All right, so you know what? I'm sorry, I should probably, I was going back to, I'm going back and forth, taking notes and stuff like that. So, Penelope, you want to go next?
That was a long,
Aledria. Sorry.
But Aledria's story.
No, I was saying, do you want to play a game, you know, like, what is it called?
This or that.
War games. Remember, the computer asked, do you want to play a game? I think it's war games, isn't it? Matthew Broderick?
I think so.
Never mind.
It's war games.
Yeah,
war games. Yep. Where he like hacks into the FBI's computer or something. Yeah. The CIA's computer or something. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, you want to play a game. So that's why I was just saying that.
Okay.
Cool. But so, Aledria says she's ready to rock. Then we're ready to listen.
Aledria.
Yes.
Give it to us. You're up.
Well, all right then. It's Aledria Hurt, and the story is called Ujima, which is the Kwanzaa principle for collective work and responsibility. Ujima, family is still everything, even when you're dead. Imani scanned down the snowy slope at the line of humans following her up the mountain. Below them, making their way quicker than those fleeing them, were the vampires who only sought to recover what Imani had stolen from them. She made a choice, and she would defend it, to the death, if necessary. Days before the mountain, Imani woke in her sacred space, her sleeping place underneath a building, and out of the setting sun. It had been mere days since she took the bloody elixir, which transformed her from a creature of day into a child of the night. She heard the sound of the waking world with new ears, still fascinated by what she contacted there. Despite her newness, she was an early riser, coming to wakefulness far before her peers who lay in their own sacred spaces around her. Their master and maker lay upon a slab above the rest of them, his body ringed in by the candles which would offer him protection from arcane attack. Should someone come upon him while he slept. They were never afforded such protection. Such was only for those who had created a coven of their own. Imani reached beneath the edge of her pallet and drew forth the sacrificial knife which would allow her to drink from the font near her master. Hunger gnawed rat-like at her insides, offering her no peace in those early moments. The first touch of the elixir on her tongue would drive it away, force it underground from her thoughts. She skimmed the room, waiting for the stirring which might have said another woke as she did. Her place as the newest of the changed meant she should not be the first to drink from the font. There were others who had more right than she to slake their thirst, but she had risen before them. Thus, she should be allowed to drink before them. Their master would not allow them all to drink, therefore being first held its own power. The gourd of the font hung near the master's sleeping pallet above the room. To reach it, she would have to move within the circle of the arcane candles. Imani hesitated. To be so bold could land her in a great deal of trouble with her new family. They had taken her from nothing, and now she needed to obey them in order to survive. Otherwise, they might well stake her out in the sun to be burned to ash. Yet the hunger bit. It did not nibble. Her vision collapsed into the gourd of the font and nothing else. Imani slipped up the stairs of the platform, up to the edge of the candles, and stopped. No, she had to wait. Her fist clenched around the knife with its decoration of thread to give it grip. The colors of her clan, her family, the place she belonged now. Above her, the tantalizing scent of the gourd drifted down. It perfumed the air with the scent of blood, Imani stared up at it, only vaguely aware of the candles at her feet as she stepped across them and into the master's sacred space. Her eyes lidded as she drew close. Her free hands came up in a lover's caress. The sweet-smelling gourd slid soapy beneath her fingers. With a flash of blade, she pierced the gourd and the first drops of precious elixir fell to her lips. Yet she hardly got to taste them before she was knocked aside by a powerful blow. "You!" her master said, giving her a moment to come to her senses. The pain of being struck cleared her mind of all else. "Young one, what do you think you are doing?" Imani did not respond. Her master, an ebony obelisk of a vampire, stood over her, but far enough away that he could not strike her again without moving. Imani did not cower, but she did lower her eyes to the level of his feet. "You are the least among us," he said. "For now." Without taking his eyes off her, he reached up and extracted her blade from the gourd. A single precious drop of elixir fell from the open hilt, and Imani swallowed a groan of want. "Take your blade and go back to bed," he commanded. He offered her the item in his open palm, the yellow curve of his ancient nails forming the beginnings of a trap. Imani stepped forward to take her blade back, intensely aware of the warmth of the candles as she drew closer to them now. He held his hand across them now, refusing her entrance into his space. He could have grabbed her. The master could have disciplined her with a stronger hand. Instead, he sent her to bed with no supper, as though she were little more than an errant child. How many times had she gone without supper in the times before? She laid back down to await the awakening of the others. "Too many times," she murmured to herself as she closed her eyes. The midnight market held every manner of thing a vampire could want. Beautiful clothes, bright gems, and pulsing hearts. Imani walked with her coven sister, Darka. They had come for the market in order to find Darka a new dress. The master had taken a shine to her and offered to make her one of his wives. The ceremony would take place within days, and they needed to be properly prepared. Darka, all a flutter with everything happening, wondered aloud, "I wonder what it will be like." She trailed off, and Imani, her thoughts elsewhere, did not pick up the thread. "Imani!" "Yes, Darka." "I asked you a question." "Forgive me, sister. Ask it again. I promise to hear this time." "I asked, what do you think it will be like, my joining with the master after all this time?" In truth, Imani had not thought about it. She didn't need to. Her status would never allow her to attain such things. Therefore, why wonder about them? However, the earnest look in her sister's eyes meant she needed to think of an answer quickly, lest she dash some dream in Darka's mind. "I'm sure it will be glorious," Imani said, joy lighting up her eyes. She wanted it to be glorious for her sister, therefore she trusted it would be. They hooked arms and continued forward into the market. Exotic pets and bolts of beautiful fabric offered themselves as gems to the eyes. Imani couldn't help looking around at everything and occasionally being distracted by the sounds of the animals. The two women stopped in various little places to consider the wares of those within, but did not find a dress which Darka thought suited her well enough for adjoining. Not quite defeated, they came to the end of the market, and Imani heard her name above the tumult of the crowd. Turning to look, Imani saw eyes she swore she would never see again. The crowd standing between them froze in time. Imani half turned to Darka, who chattered away as though nothing occurred. Imani slipped her hand out and bounded through those who stood around the world as they began to move again. A moment later, she held her sister in her arms. They exchanged words they had known from the cradle and kissed each other on the cheeks. "Sister, I love you. What happened?" It was only then Imani's arms, wrapped around her sister's neck, registered something, hiding her sister's heartbeat. They only did that to humans who were being sold. That answered what her sister was doing in the middle of the midnight market, and Imani's heart dropped. I think I'm going to stop there.
Okie dokie. I just want to say that the first thing that popped in my head is something that I love when people do when they read, or when you're writing something and you can actually paint like the picture in your head. And as you're talking, and as you're reading the excerpt, like I'm picturing like the pencils being drawn, and it's like giving me this like whole like landscape of things. And I'm picturing Imani like kind of not really, like yeah, I guess creeping towards like something she doesn't like. She doesn't know she's supposed to, like she knows she shouldn't be doing. And I was like, oh, this is so fucking good. Like it was like almost like watching a show in my head.
Ooh.
No, yeah, that and the, her okay, her story is okay, I'm just gonna be quiet. That's a great place to stop. But I'm gonna start dishing, but the rest of that story is so good. Like it's the ending, like she really made me cry. And there are only three stories in the whole thing that makes me cry. It gets like seriously emotional gut punches that like make me well up. But that's one of them. And it was so good. I could not take it.
Yeah. This was really good. And mm-hmm. Yeah, so thank you. And again, I also wrote down the defiance of Imani.
Like, yeah.
Like just and excuse for the lack of a better term, it's like fuck you, I'm hungry. Like you know, and like
yeah.
And then the he was like, how many times have I been sent to bed, like almost like a petulant child, and she murmured to herself, too many. I'm like, oh, this is good. You know what I mean? I loved it. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, awesome stuff. And I actually got to hear your episodes of your of their stories everywhere, where you did some readings of that. It was awesome stuff. I really like your reading voice too. I like everybody does. This is just a good group.
We all have voices for radio.
Penelope, would you like to go next?
LP is just muted.
Yeah, I was muted. Yes, I was. I thought Steve was going to go next. Because the night we were on, we heard everybody's story, but he said he was going to do his last. He didn't do it.
Oh, all right, Steve. And guess what? Penelope, you're up next.
All right. So I am just going to read a little bit. I did actually record something for Alidria's podcast, and it ended up being about 20 minutes long, so I do not want to do that. So I'm going to cut myself a little bit short. So the way that I write always tends to be, like I said, this adventure tense moment-to-moment sort of a thing. So you're right. I try to put the reader right there with the characters and make it very tense. So unfortunately does is make it very difficult to find excerpts, because there's always just, you're just in the middle of a big, long, you know, single thing, and it sort of doesn't ever work out that well. But so I'm going to have a little bit of overlap with what I recorded for Lydria and go a little bit past that, but it's going to be shorter. So again, the story is called No God But Hunger, and it does take place directly before the events of the Bone Eater King. And
what a great title. Ugh.
Oh, thank you.
Wish I thought it.
So the background to catch you guys up, just so there's it's not super confusing. We have two characters who are in a post-apocalyptic version of Africa. This is about 25 years after the world has been taken over by vampires. And the vampires in my world are very non-dateable. They're very very much beasts, basically, where I treated them biologically. So, you know, they have taken over the ecosystem. They are now the apex predator. The series is actually called Predator World. And it's because they and humans are just predators and everybody's just trying to survive. So the No God But Hunger title came about because, you know, this is, there was always this little bit of the Bone Eater King in the beginning when you meet this character who in the story I'm about to read is the main character. Her name's Mirela, or she goes by Ray in the main books, but in this, the other character just calls her Mirela. And she's a Ugandan woman, but she had this kind of a botched hunt where her and her partner were hunting down this leopard. And basically all that's left in Africa are the animals that, you know, 25 years on, are the animals that could survive. So pretty much predators are hunting predators. You know, you're not really able to go get a zebra or, you know, a gazelle. They're all gone. You know, everything at this point is just the scary things with teeth. Some of those are vampires. Some of them are lions. Some of them are hyenas. In this particular case, they were hunting a leopard. So that's what is happening in this particular story. They're tracking down this leopard. And what happens is we're going to come in at the point where the leopard sees something else that is in the darkness out there, and something that they were hoping to not run into. And this is basically why you don't go hunting at night in Predator world. The change that came over the leopard was instantaneous. Lips fell, ears shot straight back, lying flat against the skull. The animal's boundless rage was inexplicably gone, replaced by what I could only describe as fear. Fear, yes, but not for us. As I peered again into those darkened plains, I saw that the leopard was staring straight at the site we had passed, that collection of poles that stuck up straight in the air and had once been a camp or lodge, but could not possibly offer shelter for something like the Matsatsaku Maza. At first, the noises were different, a faint, high-pitched snarling that I recognized at once. Then the grass between us and the vertical poles began to rustle. Whatever was coming was moving fast and low to the ground. Mirela, I heard my name distantly as if in a dream. Take this. The leopard was forgotten, as was the knife in my hand. In that moment, all I could do was stare at the unseen death rustling through the grass coming straight for us. Damn it, woman! That time, Nico's voice came with a physical component. The handle of his garden hoe was pressed into me, lengthwise across my chest. I can't do this alone. Finally, I turned to him, to my partner, my friend, the first I had made in a long time. Then I pushed the garden implement back towards him. You don't have to. I kneeled to pick up a piece of broken ore from the ground. The movement caused the leopard to hiss at me before scrambling out and away, disappearing into the dark savanna. Shit, I said with a sneer. Forget the cat. Nico had his battle hoe up and ready. We'll find it again. Carry its carcass back to Jua and then eat like kings and queens. From behind my mask, I grinned. As long as we live through the next few minutes, you mean? Minutes, Nico smiled. Think this will last so long? Maybe, maybe, I said without meaning to. The set of weapons felt strange and wrong, but I had survived with less. Still, I couldn't stop wondering if I should lead with the kitchen knife or the broken piece of wood. But after another second passed, the grass parted and I had something else to think about. The Matsatsaku Maza were utterly hairless, their skin a perfect pitch black. But this only served to accentuate certain other features. The white teeth, the talon-like nails, and those hideous eyes, solid red like whole cherries. All these things flashed, but Nico and I stood our ground. For with their emergence came a small measure of relief. These four were the small kind, the sort of monster that still approximated the size and shape of men, or in this case, children. If I had to guess, none had been more than 15 when they last felt the sun on their backs, and though I knew they were all far older than they appeared, it was difficult to try to trick my eyes. I had faced others like them before, killed them too, but it had never been easy. Get the cat! I realized the pack's Alpha was a girl. She spoke in Swahili, but never more than a few words at a go. Though I wasn't fluent, I managed to keep up. Take it home, she hissed. We follow. Something like that. I watched as two broke from the rest and vanished into the outer dark. Right then I felt a great swell of outrage in my chest. They were going after the leopard. Our fucking leopard. I knew that a single bite was all it would take to spoil the meat. And that thought, at that particular moment, made me very angry. No, angry wasn't the word. We had to make this quick, to live through the next few seconds, but we also had to get that leopard. My arm muscles brimmed with frustrated potential energies, and when the moment finally came, my body shot forward, straight past Nico, straight for the Alpha. As I rushed, she stood there, unconcerned, as if an errant breeze was coming her way instead of a thoroughly pissed-off Ugandan. I think I heard my name, but it was too late for thought, too late for anything to stop the knife already thrusting down. Even so, the little bitch didn't move. I can still feel her eyes and that ever-widening piranha smile searing into my retinas. Right then, I didn't know what was making her so damned confident, but I learned. Three more appeared from the grass, hitting me in the side like a careening truck, adding their weight to the two already standing by her side as they slammed me to the ground. Even a single young leech is a dangerous thing, and right then, I had a dog pile of five to contend with. In frustration, more than anything, I screamed obscenities in their faces, for there I was again, on my back, struggling in vain, helpless, waiting for the end. I could feel them gripping my arms and neck and legs, reaching down with their little hooked fingers, giggling their insidious liquid giggles. Les enfants infernaux, that was the phrase that popped into my mind as I lay buried. Something my mother might have said. Little shits, the voice of Nico Bromson roared, cutting through the ravening hiss like a choir of fucking angels. You get off her! One shrieked, leaving my ears ringing. There was a surge in the crushing weight, and then some much-needed relief as two from the pile above were pulled away. I gasped to regain some of my lost air, then turned to my right. Nico's homemade spear had gone all the way through the first one's heart and into the ribs of the second. That was the one who had shrieked in my ear, and it was shrieking still. The three still on top of me were distracted. Seizing the moment, I thrust my knife forward, plunging it directly into one of their chests. Then I reached out and pulled the screaming thing toward me, squeezing until I saw the point of the blade stick out of its back. As it happens, the story's got a few things right. Sun burns, garlic repels, and the heart is always the spot you aim for. Thing is, the killing blow can be dealt with a consecrated stake of white oak, a kitchen knife, or pretty much anything else as long as it goes all the way through. The leech slumped down, covering me like a shroud. It was dead. I had killed something that looked a lot like a child, but I couldn't think of it like that. I had to remind my eyes that they were lying, that however this creature appeared, like its brothers and sisters, it was a predator. And worse, our competition. I'll stop there.
Oh, that was dark, intense, and scary. Thank you for that.
Intense. That was wild. I like it.
And I'm now going to have nightmares, so, you know.
Thank you.
Fuck you.
I like the fact that he got mad. You know, despite, he's like, wait a minute, is that going to spoil the meat? Mm-hmm. And just to get mad, so mad that everything is just else just goes like, I love that. That's really
Thank you. Thank you very much. I will say, I meant to say this at first, but the term that I use for the vampires in the world of the book, because the main character is Ugandan, is she calls them the Matsatsaku Maza, which is just two words in the language Hausa, which is one of the two national languages of Uganda. And it's just two words. It means, the first word, Matsatsaku, means leech. The second word means man. So she just calls them leech men. Everything, there's no bat references. I use leech references.
I like that.
Yeah.
They refer to as leeches. I like it. It's wonderful you meet other people's vampire mythologies.
Yeah, I tried to keep, you know, some stuff like in that passage, there's the line about the story's got some of the stuff right. They, mm-hmm. The sun kills, the garlic repels. And I actually go quite far to explain why garlic is offensive to vampires. So that is explained in the main book. It is also hinted that if you read this full story, No Guy But, but Hunger, it's sort of in the beginning. But there are certain things that I felt I didn't want to worry about, and I wasn't, you know, you don't have to invite them in or anything, you know. There's no truly magical stuff I tried to just shy away from. And it's funny because the one thing that I did not explain at all, but I decided to keep, was the idea that they can't cross water, which is definitely not in a lot of vampire stuff. It's not always there. It's kind of a weird one.
Yeah, but that's a demonology issue. In fact, if you have a house, like my house is old, and you have the old plantation homes, these that ilk, if you ever see them and it's painted correctly, the porch is battleship gray and the ceiling of the porch is sky blue. The reason why is because demons get confused and they don't know which way is up and they can't come into your house.
That is true.
So
I didn't know that. That's really cool.
That's part of demonology, that concept of not being able to cross water.
Huh. Oh, that's pretty cool. Well, I did add the water thing in this. So water actually burns them like acid in my world.
Cool.
And I sort of decided this is the one thing I'm not going to worry about. I'm not going to explain it. It's just, it is what it is. It's magical. I don't know. And then I am actually going to be, in 2021, I'm going to be starting the third novel. And in kind of figuring out notes and figuring out planning and you know, all the stuff, I figured out why water burns them.
Okay. And
I'm ridiculously excited about it. It's something I didn't intend to even ever explain. And I have like something that's actually rooted in science, and I'm not going to say what it is, but I'm pumped, and I do really love world building. It is one of my favorite things.
I have a question for all of you, actually. How do you take notes? For me, like if I get an idea, I roll over, get my phone, I use my note app, and I'll do the best I can to explain it so when I wake up, I can remember it. Since you're unmuted right now, how do you do that? Like when you have like something pops in your head that you know you want to add later.
Is it something that is not to do with your current project? Like you had an idea for a new project, or just something about what you're currently working on?
A little bit of both, actually.
When I'm sticking with, like for instance, what I just said about the water. Like, okay, I had this idea about the water and, you know, so I had just a notepad sort of document open that's, you know, only being written to myself. I'm literally talking to myself in there. You know, I'll say, figure something like this out. It has to be, you know, something like this I'm going for. And I'm just literally talking to myself. And it's my thought process at the time. And if I figure out details, I'll say, oh, well, why does water burn them? Blah, this is why. And then so I can go back and I can just reference that one document when it comes time to writing it. But if it's like, I had this cool idea for a story and, you know, I'm going to have these, you know, I don't know, werebats or something. And I'm like, all right, well, you know, I'm going to open up a new file and I save that as its own thing in my notes folder. And that's like, oh, I'll come up with some working title and just be like, oh, werebats of Manhattan. And just, you know, kind of write down everything that I can think of that's on top of mind, because that is the sort of stuff especially that will go away. I will never be able to reclaim that stuff when it, you know, because it's just an errant thought that comes through my brain. So I always try to make sure. And then what that allows me to do is when I'm looking, if for instance, like with Slay or any other anthology, they come along and I'm like, oh, they want a story about a transformation story. Like, oh, I have that werebats of Manhattan thing. Like, I'll go back to that. And then I'll open that up and, you know, read what I had and, you know, figure it out from there. So even if my point is to write down what's in my head and I don't look at it again for 2 years, at least it's there. You know, that's how I hang.
Aledria, how do you do that?
I'm an analog person. So I generally have paper and pen with me. I have literally sat down after movies and written on the back of receipts.
Wow. If you can see me, literally my wife finds these things all over the house.
Yeah.
To the point where she was just
I'm bad like that too. I've like post-it notes and my bullet journal and my daily journaling are all strewn with ideas. And if I have like something that I want to do, I will take like a flag and I will flag the page to remind myself that there's something on this page that's important. And then I will come back occasionally, I will flip through and I will go to all of my flags and be like, okay, what was it that was important off of here? And if it was if it still strikes me after that, when I'm looking for a new project, if it still lodges in my head when I'm looking for a new project, it becomes my next project.
Penelope, your thoughts?
Well, usually when I'm working, when I work during the day, you don't get a lot of opportunity to do stuff, but I'm always on my computer. So I'll type something out. It's just, I think something, I'll just, you know, make a notation, open a document, write it down and leave it. And it used to be for a long time that I actually slept with my laptop in the bed just in case I would wake up in the middle of the night and want to write. I mean, years I slept with my laptop in the bed. And I've just stopped doing that in like the last couple of years that I've stopped actually sleeping with the laptop in the bed. Now, when I have my phone, I have one of the, you know, and I have my phone, it's a bad phone, I gotta get a new one, but it's an LG Stylo 3 Plus, and I love the stylus. You just open it up, you create a message, and I like actually writing. I'm not one of those people that can sit there with a ticky, ticky, ticky with your thumbs and do the texting. It takes me 20 minutes to write a one-line text, okay? So I think, all right, I get out my stylo and I write, and I keep those in my phone. So something comes to me, and it's usually written in a document, you know, longhand in my phone.
So, yeah, it's kind of cool because I know I have some people who are writers and they talk, and I might have been Steve, I might have been talking to you about physically writing stuff down, and I think it was you who told me, like, it's easier to remember stuff when you actually do jot it down on paper. So, if it was you, then my wife can yell at you for finding random, like, notepads and stuff like that all around the house.
That was not me. I don't need to be yelled at. That was another person.
I don't believe
so. I also take notes on scraps of paper because, like Alondria, I am an analog person. But I also have like a Galaxy 8 phone, so I have been taking notes with my stylus, like Penelope said, on my cell phone. So it just depends on what's available. If I don't have my phone readily available, I will snatch pieces of receipts, napkins, you know, pieces of paper. Or I could use my phone and use my stylus if I have it. But those are the places. And then once a month or whenever my notes on my phone become too convoluted, I will rewrite them in a notebook. So I have this chronic, this list of, yeah. So I'm neurotic because if my notes get messy, I have to rewrite them. So or if I have groups of paper, I will take those and I would transfer them to my notebook. Or I have several journals and notebooks that are full of stuff. So, yeah.
I was actually going to ask Alita this question, but you answered it. So once you have all of it down, do you have a specific centralized notebook that you use, or do you kind of just?
I have a centralized notebook that I use, and once it's filled, I buy a new notebook or go get a new journal and just start from there. And the pages that had the unused sections or ideas, I would just tear them out, rewrite them into the new thing. I told you I'm neurotic. So
there is a
process. I've been doing this for like 20 years, so now I can't not do it this way.
Yeah.
But that's usually how it goes. I do sometimes take all the pieces of paper and see if I can make them a story, even though they're all discarded bits of flashes of like creativity. I will take them and try to like patchwork quilt them into a short story or the beginnings of a novel.
Alondria, how do you, I guess organize would be the right word, organize everything into like one central spot, or do you actually do that?
I generally don't, actually. I have just recently gone through and decided to downsize my life. So I took a large number of notebooks that I had and I just threw them away.
Wow.
Because one of the things that I have realized is that if I haven't looked at it in several years, I'm not going to remember that one striking thought. And if I'm not going to remember that one striking thought that would have gotten me started on something, then I need to be aware of the fact that ideas will continue to come. It's a scarcity mindset that had me holding on to stuff for so long. Even though I wasn't actually using it, it was because I was thinking that I would never have another good idea. And then it's like, no, I'm pretty sure that by now I have, shown myself that it is possible to continue to have ideas regardless of whether or not I write them down.
Can I just say, I want to say that I admire that, because I am a very self-conscious person, and so it may be a time for me to start downsizing as well, because I, like, getting to the point where, like, okay, I will have ideas next month, I will have ideas next week, is something that I'm just coming to terms with, you know what I mean? So it's kind of cool to know that, like, you're not alone in a situation like that.
Yeah, the hardest part about it was, for me, was just the fact that I looked at it and I said, I love some of these ideas, but I also don't remember so many of them that it's like, I can't possibly, I'm never going to be able to write every idea that comes along. I'm never going to be able to do it. And writing them all down is great if I'm going to come back to them in a timely fashion. But if I don't come back to an idea in a timely fashion, and it's in a notebook that I haven't opened in a year, I am comfortable enough now just kind of letting that go.
Oh, nice. So thank you all for the advice. I know I'm going to take all of it and use it. But hopefully...
I would say, however, see, she's young, and she doesn't have the memory issue that some of us are going to have. So my suggestion for you is scan them into your computer. Put them on the flatbed scanner. Scan them in. Maybe later on, something might click. That's what I did. I scanned mine. See, I figured that eventually you're going to get to be like, Boy George, like when he's sad and everything, he writes really, really good music. But then he starts dating somebody, gets happy, and he writes crappy music. So what you need to do is save all your sad music ideas,
Yeah.
So scan those in so that when you're happy, you don't have to worry about it because you already got them scanned in. So I say, scan it to your computer. When you get rich and you forget about how it was, when we're now poor and everything, and then you won't be able to write anymore. You have to look back at all your old ideas because we're going to forget about all the hard times. I'm bathing in Cristal now. So, what the heck? I'm not thinking about sad stories and monsters. My life is great. Yeah, scan that stuff.
Before you start your excerpt from your story, I just want to say that bathing in Cristal sounds like the stickiest thing ever.
There are stickier things, but I write erotica, so let's not go there.
Hell!
Oh God, the amount of things that just ran through my head. Okay. So Penelope, can you give us your excerpt, please, if you'd like? If you'd like, obviously.
Mine is very short. I'm trying to cut it up into little pieces. It will be a little bit disjointed, but that's okay. Because it is referring to, like I said, the previous story of when the individual, the prefect, her name is Yanara, meets with RM, who is the individual that we now know to be Renfield. And I won't go far. It'll just be a little fragment of the story.
What's the story called?
Unfleaned. The clock chimed, and both Yanara and RM glanced toward the mantel. I've been away for quite a while. My staff will begin to worry, she said. RM stood, straightening his clothes. If your mind speak is still disabled and you are unable to link with your driver, I will gladly walk to the corner and call you a cab. No, I'm fine. She waved him back to his seat. The biscuits have worked wonders. I should be able to link with my staff within the hour. While we wait, I'm curious as to what you are proposing in return for my vouchsafe. If you take me into your confidence, I can tell you what House Striga may be planning. Is that a fact? She asked, impressed. What is it that you know? Arim took a deep breath, then steadied himself before saying, despite the cordiality and protest to the contrary, House Striga will not cede power to House Ekimu. Yanara bit her lip and knitted her brow. So it's true then. I presumed that this was sending Sebastian to Morocco to leave me vulnerable. I never thought House Striga had the means, not here in London. House Striga is formidable. We have many ties throughout the paradox. I recall the last time we were challenged. Our house's enemies met unfortunate ends, but you, in particular, have raised their ire, most notably from our revenants. How so? She took a sip from her cup. Our lives are to be dedicated to the care and maintenance of the revenants. True, there has been some brutality, some injuries, but that is to be expected. He raised his cup, but took no sip. It is the only reason that they created us. Pardon, but I was created from a deep love between my parents. On either side of my hybridized lineage, patrilineal and matrilineal, there have only been hybrids for over 3 millennia, not one revenant. Certainly through them, we have gained supernatural abilities, which we have utilized for our and their benefit. Our clan owes much to the revenants, but we do not owe them our dignity, nor our lives. Most prefects have said these same words, however, you were the first to act upon them, he sipped. No other prefect has ever had the temerity to deny services to a revenant. You have denied several. We do not ask for much, only to be treated with respect when we manage their households and business interests. By and large, most revenants act within the prescribed guidelines. Only a handful have been excommunicated. That is a harsh sentence, he said. And maiming and murdering our people is not harsh? It is. But there are some, especially in House Striga, that have taken profound offense, who believe that we should act more humbly. And I am supposed to care that these scoundrels are offended? They should all be more concerned that we are not offended. We managed every facet of their lives. They are the ones who should act with more humility. He sighed and rubbed his temples and then whispered to himself, I don't know why he bothered with someone who apparently has a death wish, whose days are numbered. Excuse me, what did you just say? Yanara glared across the table. I said nothing, most eminent. No, you said my days were numbered. What are you not telling me? Yanara rose and strolled over to where Arim sat. He dropped his head, holding the teacup rattling in his trembling hands. Look at me, she said. I dare not, Eminence. Tell me. She leaned in, reached under his chin, and tipped his head upward until his gaze met hers. His eyes grew large and limpid as she commanded just over a whisper. Tell me. Her eyes were hypnotic, welcoming, conveying love and acceptance. No individual as lonely and unloved as he had any chance of resistance. His voice was hushed as he spoke as one infatuated. House Striga is sending a prime to London. Yanara's breath hitched, but she maintained her gaze of steadiness. A prime? Yes, he said, an ancient. It is rumored that he is one of the originals, an Abesian. Are you certain? She smiled. The preparations and approvals to send a prime through deep transport are complex. As a prefect of this region, I certainly would have been informed of it. His shoulders bowed and shuddered as he tried to disconnect from her, but she leaned in closer. Come now, what would you want to keep from me? He ceased struggling and relaxed into her eyes at her touch. Prefect, for all the centuries I have lived, the Strigan Council has never spoken a word to me, not once. However, 4 months passed, I had a visitor, a messenger from the council. They requested that I commission a solicitor for a real estate transaction here in London. When I told them I was quite capable of handling the transaction, the messenger, in no uncertain terms stated that I was not to facilitate the transaction. I was only to provide the information to a capable Paradoxon solicitor. And did you?
Well, certainly. At first I thought the request was being made due to their lack of faith in my capabilities. But just now, it occurred to me that they requested a Paradoxon because they didn't want the transaction to appear in our records. Yanara breathed in and then blew out a long breath. Is there anything else? Well, during this period, the messenger asked that I arrange to have several pieces of cargo imported. 51 crates. Do you know what was in them? At first, I did not. Then the dockmaster in Varna sent word inquiring as to when to send the 50 crates of soil. Yanara's eyes narrowed. And when were these crates sent? 2 months ago, the ship set sail. Yanara dropped her hand and stepped away as RM shook his head as if waking from a dream. Do you have any idea who it is that you have invited to London? I have invited no one. I have only done as I was told. She stared at him, quietly fuming. The fiend who lives solitary with not one of our kind in his service, the animal in the Carpathians who famously gorged himself on the flesh of our brethren, now through your actions is on his way to London. No! Oh, no, Eminence, I had no knowledge. He grabbed Yanara by the hand and pressed her palm to his forehead. See? Look, I only did what I was told. Yanara held her hand to his forehead and connected with his consciousness. She saw no guile or deceit with regard to what he had reported. But there, in the convoluted paths, was so much loneliness, self-loathing, and degradation that she almost wept. She pulled her hand away. I know you have been truthful. The sounds of wheels alerted her. My carriage is approaching. You will leave now? He asked, almost tearful. There's much to be done. I cannot yet do as you have asked, but I will not leave you without compensation. Yanara's nails sharpened and elongated, curving into razor-sharp talons. She nicked a spot on her forearm, near her left wrist. As the blood began to flow, Arm's face contorted into a grimace. She regarded him with a quirked brow. Is there a problem? I was under the impression that you partook. Oh, yes, Eminence. It is just that it was rumored you have nursed a member of our house, that you have given suck, he grinned, fawning, from your breast. Yanara's face tightened. The information you provided was useful, but this, a claim on my body that only those most dear to me have earned, you presume far too much. Pardon, Eminence, I meant no offense. Then he dove upon the wound she created, and for a full minute she watched him lapping, drinking, devouring at the font until she pressed against his shoulder, signaling him to leave off. She watched as he slouched back into his chair, exhausted and out of breath. The words presumptuous and obsequious came to mind.
That woman is sexy.
Yeah.
That was a few things that I noted. One was it was the only reason we were created, and then immediately got checked for that.
Yes.
And then and as a black male, something that that really took me back was we don't own them our dignity or our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So yeah, I just want to make sure that like I did that.
Yeah.
I mentioned that. And then like her intimidation was sexy as hell. Lifted his head and said and whispered, "Tell me."
Mm-hmm.
And it's like it's scary, and sometimes like even the most intimidating people, like it is like very attractive. It is very sexual, and I was like, "Oh, this is great."
Yeah, thank you.
Anybody have anything else?
I mean, that was awesome.
Thank you.
And again, I will listen to you read the phone book, Penelope.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Stereo instructions, whatever you got.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I just like the fact that we get to see Renfield.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember him being a very interesting character to me as someone who was the first to meet Dracula.
Yes.
Because he was sent to the Carpathians to broker the deal before Harker was. And when he comes back and he's mad, it's right at the beginning of, I want to say it's the Coppola version that I noted, that where they have the discussion where they talk about Renfield, but you haven't seen him yet.
Yes.
And you're like, wait, he's mad after having gone to this place and now we're sending somebody else? And it's like, okay.
Everybody does their take on the Renfield thing. In my story, of course, Renfield hires the attorney that brokers the deal, because of course we've got a lot of intrigue going on within the different houses of the Revenants and the Renfields. Every Renfield is part of a Revenant house. So my main character, Yanara, is Ekimu. And all these names are names of different types of vampires all over the world. The Kangxi, the Ekimu, the Mpundulu, the Striga. All these are names, you know, world name cultures that refer to vampires. La Lamia House. All of these are the different houses. And in our mythology, there are more houses. But these are the only houses that came from their particular universe into our universe for this expedition. The others didn't think it was worthy of their time and effort, but these were the intrepid explorers who came over and who have houses, their houses now, not unlike, you know, the Medici or the Borgias, that they have their own hierarchies.
So
very cool. I love that world mythology aspect, and that's something that I also researched. Did you come across the Sasabonsam from Ghana?
Yes, but I had to limit it because I could only do so many. And so it's like every different type, I mean, and everyone is different, because in fact, for instance, there's some that I took the name, but not the fact, like Kangxi are supposed to be like covered in fur and all this kind of stuff. And I didn't go that way. They're all, you know, they have things that can grow the fur, but it's not like they walk around all day, you know, in fur, you know, cloth. So yeah, everyone's kind of shape-shifting. Everything in Renfield's shape-shifts. Everything.
Well, that's dope. I want to know more. Like I said, I didn't know much about him. And when you brought the Bram Stoker, I was like, oh, I remember him from the movie.
Dracula, yeah.
And I was like, oh, and I've seen that movie a million times, and actually saw it when I was 9, I think.
Wow.
Snuck into my parents' room and like watched it. And my dad got up because he heard moaning. He's like, what was going on? And he thought that it was on. And he cut it off right when Dracula was like devouring someone. He goes, no, you don't see me. And he goes, what are you doing? I said, I was just watching Dracula.
Yeah. Because some of those things are scary. I mean, I remember seeing Nosferatu, a double feature of The Hunger, and Nosferatu at the Theater of the Living Arts in Philadelphia many years ago. And I mean, it was great because it was like Halloween and the weather was getting cold and we had to graveyard to get there. I mean, I will remember that for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
That was an experience. And even that, like in The Hunger, that type of vampiric situation where, I mean, she is ancient. But then on the other hand, you have people who are trying to use science to try to figure what is going on with this. And they, you know, it's so I like that the science versus the mythology. And so many of us now, you know, we grew up at a time where there was so much science fiction, and a lot of things that were science fiction have now become science fact. So it's going to be interesting, you know, when they find out, well, yeah, vampirism really did exist, but it was X, Y, and Z, you know, as they do now, saying, right. certain conditions, you know, people can't go out into the sun, and people had certain presumptions when the dead body was in the grave, and they, oh my gosh, they're still growing their hair and their nails, so they must be alive and jumping out at night with this blood on their mouths, what the hey? So all of these things, and but it makes a fun thing to write about.
So what you're saying is mermaids exist, and I can tell my co-host that he's wrong. All right, this has been the Old Man Wade. This has been the Old Man Wade Show. I want to thank all of you for coming on and doing this. I would love to have you all come on again individually or together, whether it be to talk more about the projects you're working on, or if you just want to come on and talk shit with me. But before we go, I want to make sure that everyone gets a chance to talk about where they can be found. So, Aledria, tell everyone where they can find you.
I am one of those people who's lucky enough that if you can spell my first name, I'm the first 5 pages of Google.
A-L-L-E-D-R-I-A, next name Hurt, H-U-R-T.
Yep, if you can spell my name, you can literally find me because I am, according to Google, a one and only.
Oh, that's wow. Dope. That's dopeness.
you a true original.
Yeah, and then I can tell you a really horrible story about how supposedly that happened, but I won't say that on this show.
Well, if you'd like to come back on, you can tell it because we've said some pretty ridiculous things. Steve's been on the show; he's heard the show. So, Steve, where can they find you?
Find me on Amazon, find me on Twitter, on Facebook. All you got to do is look up Steve Van Sampson. And the trick is there's no P in Sampson. It's just Samson. And write vampire books and other stuff. I got lots of stories and anthologies. And the thing I'm most excited about, which I hinted at earlier, is my new book, which is coming out from Rough House Publishing. This winter, we're calling it winter. We haven't set an actual date. I think we're talking probably January, though, at this point, because 2020 has been a lot. Mm-hmm. So that is called The Mark of the Witchworm, and it is a dark fantasy tale, and it is about a guy who is trying to save his son, who is dying of a incurable disease, and he has made the very difficult decision to, against his family's wishes, he has left to go out on this last ditch ridiculous Hail Mary quest to try to find the man that he thinks can save his son instead of just being by his son's side in his last month on earth. So it is something I tried to do with fantasy to make it more heavy and to make it personal. This is it's a father's story, and but it's a fantasy world, and there are monsters. There's always monsters with me, and hopefully people will check that out and follow me for updates on that Mark of the Witchworm.
All right,
Penelope, where can they find you?
PenelopeFlynn.com is my website. You can find me as Penelope Flynn Media on Facebook. Other Sci-Fi is also a Facebook group and page that I work on through. Renfields.us or Renfields.net, both of them, for my Renfields. It has its own website, so I'm little by little gathering much on that. Instagram, Penelope J. Flynn. Twitter, Penelope J. Flynn. And you can, again, catch me in the mornings, Monday through Friday, on twitch.tv/amazingxp. And Saturday nights, 9 o'clock Eastern time, Other Sci-Fi, Discussions from the Other Hood on TalkShoe.
And last but certainly not least, Nicole.
You can find me at NicoleGibbonsKurtz.net. You can definitely check out Slay, Stories of the Vampire Noir, and our other works that amplify marginalized voices in speculative fiction at MochaMemoirsPress.com. We are on Twitter at MochaMemoirs, and I am on Twitter at Nicole G. Kurtz. You can also find us on Facebook under Nicole G. Kurtz and MochaMemoirsPress. You can also find our Instagram. It's also MochaMemoirsPress.
Okie dokie. Sorry we didn't get to the game. It was a little silly one, but it was basically a this or that, and you pick one or the other. But I will ask one of them before I go. I just have to actually find the Google Doc. Here we go. Worst performance from Keanu Reeves: Bram Stoker's Dracula or Devil's Advocate?
I mean, oh, Dracula.
I mean, Dracula, because, yeah.
Dracula.
Dracula.
It
was kind of painful.
I know a British accent.
I wish they would have just, like, changed his, like, he's the cousin from California or something. Instead of trying to make him earn that or wear that accent, it just was a horrible fit.
He's Ted Harker.
He's Ted Harker.
Yeah, the British accent versus the like Mississippi accent that he does in Devil's Advocate, he does a much, much better like Southern-esque drawl in Devil's Advocate than he does trying to be British in Dracula.
Agreed.
Yeah.
All right, this has been the Old Man Wade Show. You can find me at oldmanwadecom on Twitter and Instagram. You can also find me on the Old Man Wade Show Facebook page, where we post memes, we talk a little shop. It's mostly goofy. Sometimes we do discuss some topics that are heavy to the heart. Like we are heavy on making sure that Black lives and LGBTQ lives are represented in a positive light. So you can find me at Super Bowl Hobby there. Does anybody have any final words?
Yes, one thing. Keanu Reeves, if you're listening to this, I was not laughing at you. It is cool. It was them, not me.
Damn it, Wade!